Great to see you again. It's been, I guess, eight, 9 years.
Yeah. I think it was 81, I think.
That was on the occasion of the Glitter Dome.
The Glitter Dome.
Yeah, that was a great book. And a great cover on that, too. And since that time, you have written...
Well, let's see.
Delta there. Star?
Yeah, and then Lines and Shadows.
Secrets of Harry
Secrets
Bright?
Secrets of Harry Bright, Echoes in the Darkness, and now The Blooding. So I've done a lot of writing since then.
Boy, you really have. It's great. This is Blooding is a terrific book.
Thank you, Doc.
It's so good, in fact. It's the kind of book that you can sit in one, read in one sitting, which is exactly what I did.
Oh, good.
Sunday afternoon, about noon, and I put it down about 7 or 8 o'clock that night.
Oh, dear.
You know, and it's really kind of sad when you think about it. You can read books a lot faster than they can be written.
A lot faster, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about you, and then we'll work up to the Blooding. It's, I know... from my last conversation with you, that you grew up in Pittsburgh. Did you go to college there?
No, I moved from East Pittsburgh to California when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And went to school in California from then on.
So inherently, you're a Californian, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
Pittsburgh.
By now.
A long way back. Yeah, I lived in Pittsburgh, but only during my high school years. Then I went off to college and went back briefly as a radio announcer in a small station in Ambridge, but that... last about 6 weeks, things like that happen in broadcasting.
Oh, yeah.
So what happened? You went out at the age of 14 and to California, and I guess at some point you became interested in law enforcement. How did that come about?
Well, my dad was a cop when I was a kid, so perhaps first impressions, you know, made an impression on me. I don't know. When I got out of the Marines... I went to college for a while, and when I was just on the verge of graduation, that is getting my B.A. in literature, in English, I decided I didn't want to be a teacher after all, which is what I thought I wanted to be, and I impulsively went down and signed up for the test to be a Los Angeles policeman. I noted that they paid better than teachers got paid anyway, and I thought it might be a little more interesting for me at the age of 23, and so there I stayed.
You did. How long were you on the force?
For 14 years.
Was it always a uniform job that you had?
No, I was only in uniform for a few years, and then it was various plainclothes jobs. I was a detective when I left, a sergeant.
You wrote a book during your tenure on the police force.
I wrote three of them.
Three of them, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote The New Centurions, The Blue Knight, and The Onion Field. I took a leave of absence for 6 months to write The Onion Field. Then I went back to the police department, and then my fame was overtaking me and making it very difficult to do police work, so I pulled the pin, as we say.
Yeah, I guess you were kind of a controversial figure because you told about police work as it was. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, and just it's just merely the fact of appearing on Johnny Carson and doing all this stuff. When you become rather recognizable, at least your name becomes recognizable, it makes it impossible to do an everyday civil service job.
Yeah, and I suppose the hours and the weekends and the holiday work and just the stresses that go with a policeman's work would also make it very difficult. I mean, three books and having a full-time job.
Three books. I was promoting books. I was dealing with the new experience of celebrity, at least celebrity insofar as a writer's concerned. I've always maintained that a writer is not a real celebrity, but he's a semi-celebrity.
Semi-celebrity.
And that was difficult enough. At the time, I was... a burglary detective, but I was assigned to homicide for a while, and I remember getting called out three nights in a row at 2 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't getting any sleep, and I thought, you know, what am I? Am I a writer? Am I a cop? What's going on here? And I knew the writing was on the wall. I would have to make a choice.
Well, you obviously made the right one. Did the writing get you in trouble with your superiors at all?
Yeah, initially it did, and then...
What happened?
Well, there was so much notoriety immediately. Policemen had never written a book before, at least not a novel. I mean, policemen, I suppose, had written textbooks and things on crime investigation and criminal justice and things like that. I think a few policemen had attempted that sort of thing, but I don't believe a policeman had ever written a novel, certainly not a novel that was an immediate bestseller. And we had to have permission to write anything, and I didn't have it because I knew I could never get it. to write a novel. I just wrote it because the novel was in me and I wanted to get it out. And I just wrote it and thought I'd take my chances with the chief. And there was a lot of publicity when I got into disciplinary problems, but I think the press made the administration back down.
Mm. What sort of disciplinary problems?
Well, I could have theoretically been fired for the offense, you know.
For actually writing the book?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I see. What happened? You're 14 years in the force, huh?
Yes.
Then what happened?
Well, then I just became a full-time writer. I was involved in television for a while. I created a show called Police Story, which was on some years ago and was a successful show. And I became involved in a peripheral way in movies and then became involved rather heavily in movies. I made the Onion Field film from my book.
Did you produce that?
Yeah, I wrote it, and I formed the production company. You know, I hired a line producer, but I formed the production company, raised the money. It was my baby, you know, invested in it. That's how dumb I am. And then I made The Black Marble.
Well, why do you say that was dumb?
Because everyone in Hollywood except me knew that one must never invest one's own money in a movie. Nobody does that. Nobody. You can name the most famous producers you have ever heard of, and I'll guarantee you they've never put a dime of their own money in anything they've produced.
But that was a successful film, wasn't it?
Well, that's the reason they don't put their own money in it. Yes, it was successful in that everyone seems to have seen the movie, and I never made a nickel from it. Not a nickel. So that's why it's not done.
How can that be?
Well, you said there are a lot of creative people in Hollywood, including bookkeepers. Creative accounting. I suppose. I don't know. It just seems as though a movie never earns back its costs somehow, unless it's a runaway box office success that keeps people from hiding the profits.
I don't see how movies are made anyway. I mean, it takes so many people to do it, and so many producers, and you have to find directors and raise the money, and you just wonder how it ever happens.
I had to do it. I did it, and I'll never do it again that way. Now, when I get involved in something from my books, and I wrote the teleplay for Echoes in the Darkness, if it was a four-hour for CBS, why, I was a hired hand. I was an assistant or associate producer. I forget what they called me, but it was my screenplay, my teleplay, and I got paid for it, so I made money for it, and I worked, you know, for CBS and for the production company, and believe me, that's a lot less stressful than trying to form your own company and finance your own films. That's ridiculous.
After all these years of being a writer, do you ever look back and say, gosh, I wish I were back on the LAPD?
Well, you know, I have recurring dreams about that, and I think that's probably a wish to return to a simpler time. When life seemed a lot less complicated. But I am what I am, which is a writer. I was trained to be a policeman. I was probably born to be a storyteller.
Policemen are different. Their lives are different. They usually associate among themselves. They're cliquish, aren't they? Their whole lives are structured differently than anybody else's. Isn't that right?
It becomes a clannish way of life because policemen, like other minority group members, think that no one understands them unless they're members of the same minority group. Hence, policemen, you know, develop a little paranoia and think that people don't like them. And in many cases, they're right. A lot of people don't like authority symbols, and that's what they are. They're authority symbols, and American people in particular just don't like authority. They don't want anyone telling them what to do. Americans are extremely independent, very contentious people. So they're not an easy people to police. They're probably the hardest people on earth to try to police. Police, not please. Well, both. So you can't win.
Yeah, and they're also potentially dangerous, all these guns.
We're dangerous people. We have a degree of freedom that is unknown anywhere, including in all other civilized countries. Wherein there are restrictions on one's unfettered, quote-unquote, freedom to do whatever one wishes, unless it's a major felony. In other countries, there are restrictions imposed from church, family, society in general on one's behavior. There's, in short, discipline. in America, we're becoming an utterly undisciplined society, it seems to me, and the crime statistics are reflecting it. Not just robbery and burglary and those sorts of statistics, but murder statistics are reaching an incredible peak, where I think something will have to be done. And we are...
It's supposed to be this crack, isn't it? The drugs?
Oh, I don't know. You can blame it on crack. You can blame it on assault rifles, which is, of course, a plague in Los Angeles. But I blame it on unfettered freedom to do whatever the hell one wants to do. And you can't run a society like that. I mean, there have to be some sort of controls that people have to be able to discipline themselves as a society. Every other country is disciplined. I shot my movie Echoes in the Darkness in Toronto. And compared to a major American city of the same size, I assure you, that was a safe, civilized place to be. You know, you could go a few miles away into Buffalo and try walking the street at 2 a.m. as you could in Toronto. Well, that says something for the Canadian people, you know. They haven't... they don't want to live in this with this unlimited license that we call freedom. We have a few trials going in Los Angeles at the present time, which are going to cost an average of $10 million each to prosecute. That's not due process anymore. I mean, that's not concern for civil liberties. That's madness. I mean, there's no trial of a felon for who commits ordinary violent crime that should require 8 months or 10 months or a year and $10 million of taxpayers' money. That's got nothing to do with reality anymore. There's no other country that such a system exists. So we're getting the crime we deserve because we're putting up with it. We're a nation of lawyers who have us paralyzed.
You're talking about, you're criticizing the fundamental social structure of this country, but yeah. What do you do? I mean, where would you start?
Well, what do they do in England? What do they do in Canada? What do they do in Australia, Germany, France?
But they have a different population structure. We have so
Why?
Many different racial and ethnic groups all clashing together. It's not like those other countries.
I don't blame this on racial strife. I blame this on the unfettered lust for what we call freedom that Americans require. And I think it's simply become license. Everyone wants to do as he pleases. Let's discipline the other guy and the other group. I don't think it's necessarily a racial mix that's causing this. We have a tremendous wave of immigration in Los Angeles, but I don't think it's the immigrants that are causing the problem.
Well, what freedoms would you restrict in order to get us on
restrict
track?
Restrict all freedoms somewhat. I mean, do I absolutely need unlimited freedom to own the weapon of my choice? You know, surely we can get by without assault rifles, just starting with that. Surely we can afford the money easier to build more prisons to house recidivist offenders and sociopaths who are beyond redemption when it comes to rehabilitation. One cannot rehabilitate a sociopath. Part of this book, The Blooding, is about a definition of the sociopath. There are about, in my opinion, several hundred thousand sociopaths running amok, and people are talking about being unable to hold folks in prison because it's too expensive. It's cheap compared to letting these people live amongst us. It's cheap compared to $10 million jury trials for one man who happens to murder about 12 people. The alternative of building prisons is cheap. We are always going to have several hundred thousand people in this country who are beyond redemption, and they must be locked up when they commit crimes, and we cannot talk about rehabilitating them.
Yeah, I think it was established a long time ago that prison never rehabilitates anyone. I think the problem, I mean, you're absolutely right, these people should be locked up, but the problem is recognizing the fact that they are beyond redemption and working within a framework of law. I think our courts don't want to make the mistake of locking somebody up, if indeed he is can be redeemed. You just don't know. It's such a how do you tell?
Well, I think there are enough clinical symptoms of the psychopath and the sociopath that his history makes it fairly clear. In addition to the multiple examinations that these people undergo during the course of a life of crime by experts, by psychiatrists and others, you know, that make it perfectly clear when you have a psychopath, a sociopath. And by that I mean a person without this mechanism we call a conscience, a person who is unable to love or receive love, a hedonistic, impulsive, controlling, manipulative person who commits antisocial acts with impunity, who feels that he's fortunate not to be fettered with a conscience. I think it becomes fairly clear through the course of his criminal life when we have one. And when we have one and he commits a crime, we can't continue to talk about rehabilitation of this person.
Well, I've lived in New York for more than 20 years, and there have always been crimes and there have always been criminals. But within the last couple of years, I've become nervous and frightened as I walk down the street because I've been menaced a number of times. And I'm talking about the last couple of years. I'd never been menaced before, even though I've seen, read about crime, reported on crime, but it had never affected me directly. For example, just 2 weeks ago, my wife was sitting on a subway, and a man ran up to her. She had never seen this person before, and he threw something at her, and it burst. It was like tobacco or something, and then he began to hit her with his fist and screamed, and a couple of passengers got her away, and they stopped the train, and he's ranting and raving. They hide my wife behind a pillar, and the motorman tries to get a transit cop. You can never find a cop when you need it. At any rate, she was stunned. I mean, somebody just, an obvious insane person. Never seen her before. She was shaking. I mean, she had been physically violently attacked. This person could have murdered her. And I don't know why this is. I don't know if it's because of drugs, crack, angel dust. I suspect it has a lot to do with it. But I feel there's a heavier level of violence now than I felt before. Is this your impression?
Yes, and once again, I repeat, I believe building prisons is cheap for the taxpayer compared to the alternative.
The destruction that they cause.
The destruction, the grief, the blood, the tears, and running them through the court system again and again and again. That's where the expense lies. That's where the expense lies. We have to hire judges and lawyers and the entire monumental elephantine system that we call American law. We have to support this monster to run these people through again and again and again. It would be far easier to house them for $20,000 a year.
Well, let's talk about the blooding. This is a really interesting book. You obviously, I can't remember the names of the towns, the Narborough mm-hmm. village, the three villages there. You must have spent a good deal of time there. Tell me about this.
Well, I tracked the Narborough murders, and I think it was the New York Times, actually, wherein I learned that there was a psychopathic killer, obviously a psychopathic killer, because they're the ones that commit these kinds of crimes, stalking the village footpaths in a little place called Narborough in Leicestershire, England, which is in the Midlands, in a place where there had never been a murder before. A girl was murdered in 1983 and then again in 86 another one was murdered, both 15 years old, both on village footpaths, one footpath called the Black Pad, one called 10 Pound Lane, and both of these footpaths were divided by the grounds of a psychiatric hospital, and the police thought it might be one of the inmates who was roaming the footpaths and ambushing these girls. The entire village area was terrorized, you can imagine, in a place where such things are not supposed to happen. That was fascinating. That was sort of an Agatha Christie story. That wouldn't have brought me into it, however. Then I read where a young geneticist named Dr. Alec Jeffries at Leicester University, nearby the villages, had discovered something that he called genetic fingerprinting. When I read about it, I really didn't believe it was possible. It seemed incredible that Jeffries had found a way to map the human DNA. That is the master molecule of life. It's in every cell. And he said that he could map a person's DNA and identify a single human being from all others on the face of the earth on the basis of blood or semen or hair root or bone or skin or even material like saliva and sweat and urine. I didn't believe the claims. It seemed impossible. And I read further that the police of Leicestershire had a suspect in these terrifying murders, and he had confessed, and that they were going to test Jeffrey's system on this confessed murder because, strangely enough, he'd only confessed to the second murder. He wouldn't confess to the first one, even though the M.O. proved to any policeman's satisfaction that the man who murdered the first girl was the same murderer of the second girl. The M.O.s were identical. They went to Jeffries to make a case against the first girl, and Jeffries had some very bad news for the policeman. That is, that the man they were preparing to prosecute didn't murder either girl, according to his genetic fingerprinting technique. Well, then the police, of course, were sorry they ever went to him in the first place. They thought he was a crackpot. They didn't believe in genetic fingerprinting anymore. They said, well, it's impossible. We have a confessed murder. As far as we're concerned, we have the man. And Jeffries, through the irrefutable technology that he had developed, which was examined carefully by the Home Office forensic scientists, convinced all the scientists in attendance that his system was indeed foolproof and unassailable, which meant that it didn't matter that the man had confessed, he was innocent. So the police had to release their confessed murderer, keep an eye on him, and proceed as though Jeffrey's technology really worked, even though the police didn't really believe that it was possible. So they set about blood testing 4,000 young men who lived in a three-village area around that countryside. They blood tested every young man in the villages who came forward voluntarily. A lot of them wouldn't come forward voluntarily, and then it was up to the police to try to persuade them or to find out why they didn't want to be tested, because they always assumed that their murderer would not come forward and voluntarily give his blood for this new genetic fingerprinting miracle. And they were right. The murderer did not. The murderer found a way to beat their test, not scientifically, but through some clever manipulation of a friend. Then when I read that they had someone who was no doubt the real murderer, and that was in October of 87, I thought, when he goes to trial, I am going to go to England on one condition, that there's not another writer from England doing a book. If there was, I wouldn't try to compete with him or her, because it's their country, it's their case, and it's their miraculous discovery, genetic fingerprinting, which I believed by then, from further study, was going to revolutionize crime detection. Crime will never be the same again as a result of Jeffrey's discovery. And I knew that if it had a real test and America really learned about it, it would sweep America, as indeed it's doing right now. I went to England a year ago this time. Right about a year ago today, I was in England, freezing in a little village of Narborough, in a B&B, a bed and breakfast, where the wind blew through a gale every night, and I thought about the glamorous life of a writer, and I had to go and cajole and beg for interviews from village people in the Midlands of England who didn't necessarily know who I was or care. In terms of any sort of notoriety I might have as a writer, but I had something going for me. The footpath killer had finally been caught. The village was at last released from the grip of terror, and people were glad that it was over, and they were finally able to talk about it, something which had frightened them, something which had shamed them. They were actually ashamed these English people, because nothing like this had ever happened to them before in their villages, villages of 900 years old. And it was the humiliation of it. The outsiders from all over the world were coming in to see about this strange and bizarre thing called genetic fingerprinting, which was being used to trap a terrifying killer who was one of them, a villager. By then they knew it had to be a villager. It wasn't some outsider from the motorway, which is what they would have preferred to believe. It was one of them. And so they were willing to talk, finally, and I just happened to be there. And I was the only one there, because the Brits do not particularly like true crime writing. They think that that's perhaps beneath the dignity of a serious writer who should do Agatha Christie-type genre murder mysteries and not this sort of thing. But I felt that their discovery of genetic fingerprinting was an historical event for forensic science and crime detection. Historical. And I wanted to write the first book.
And this was the first case in which it was used as extensively.
Yes. They used... Jeffries tried it out once in a rape case. And it stood the test in the trial. But no one heard about that case. And then came the Narborough murders. Quickly, very shortly after he tested it in a rape case and, testified. And the Narborough murders gave him the opportunity to provide the publicity for his discovery, which he felt that it needed, and he was right. It did. Very quickly, there were stories all over the world about this marvelous discovery and how it was used to trap this terrible killer. And then it was picked up, that is, the discovery picked up and used, I think, in 8 states or 10 states, something like that now. We're using it. It will be in all 50 states in the next couple of years, and the FBI laboratory is gearing up, I think, to do massive genetic fingerprinting work in the coming years, and I believe they'll have DNA files someday, the way they have fingerprint files now.
When you were in Narborough doing your research, I somehow see England as somewhat more closed than the United States. But you had access to police records, and of course you had a great contact with that police inspector. I forget his name.
Well, yeah, Morris there's
Pierce.
His name
is Pierce.
Yes, there's an extremely interesting police inspector who was on this murder inquiry by the name of Derek Pierce, and he's as good as any that I've ever invented in fiction, because he's not your standard stiff upper lip. Rock-jawed detective that we expect in, the British murder mysteries. This guy is so intense and high-strung, that he vibrated. This guy was so full of energy and so volatile, unlike your average Englishman, and so controversial.
He was a good Wombaugh character.
He was. He was born to be a character in my book, and volatile. To boot, which is also unusual for an Englishman, and he was garrulous. He liked to talk, and that's extremely unusual for an English policeman. Whom the English, of course, are much more reticent than Americans, and an English policeman is much more reticent than the average Englishman. He's afraid to talk about too much. I mean, everything's a secret. But I was lucky to have him because he talked.
And the police records, all available to you?
Well, I feel there's some controversy about that going on, by the way, in England at the present time. Whether I got access to things that an ordinary writer or journalist wouldn't get access to. In fact, frankly, there's a big internal police investigation going on in Leicestershire, wherein some high-ranking officers are under investigation to see if they violated a Data Protection Act and gave me information that they shouldn't have given me. I maintain that I got information which was available to any writer or journalist after the fact, after the case is adjudicated, which is when I went there, days after the adjudication. And I also maintain that I was able to get facts that other people had never gotten because I'm a good investigator. I've done a lot of investigation in my time, and I've done a lot of writing about crime. More than almost anybody, as far as true crime is concerned. I've probably written as much about it as anybody going today. So I had a couple things going for me. I'd like to think that I'm able to get information from a policeman or anybody else during the course of an interview that most people can't get. I know what they're saying and I know what they're not saying. I am able to fill in some gaps and some blank spots due to my experience.
I imagine it was tougher there, though. What about the autopsy reports?
Yeah, it's all that.
That's part of
things that I ferreted out in my
own.
It's
part of their investigation, how you got all these.
Yeah.
In the United States, it's really easy to get these. I mean, through
much
the Freedom of Information Act. Or usually they don't even hassle you. You ask for them, they give them to you.
Would have been much easier to get information, and believe me, it's not that easy to make some English people talk, because in a country where reticence is valued and keeping your mouth shut is considered a virtue, it's difficult to persuade people to be non-virtuous and start talking. Whereas with Americans, you get an American talking and you can't shut him up.
Unless they're from Minnesota. But I noticed you were there long enough that you have all of the British terminology, English terminology,
yeah.
Telly, and a whole bunch of, I can't remember everything. I think you call it motorway, and a whole bunch of other references use their language.
I tried to write in their language, English, and I tried to pick up... I tried to pick up the slang and the dialect and all that. I wanted to feel authentic. I wanted to feel to Americans and to British people that it's sort of a mid-Atlantic voice telling this story. Because I knew that if I was successful, I might get something I've never gotten before, and that is a simultaneous publication all over Britain and the English-speaking world, and as well as America. Because of the English setting, I've been able to do that. So this book is being released in England as well as here, and I'm going from New York to London to promote the book. So I wanted a voice that would be true to the spirit of the story, and yet would be an understandable voice for Americans as well as for the English. So I was very, very careful in how the language I used to tell the story.
These homicide investigators weren't too experienced, because I think you mentioned they only had maybe one murder a year, but they worked hard. They did show good police work, don't you think?
Oh yes, they did indeed. And usually the murder that they had was not a whodunit; it was just some domestic murder. And of course here they had a couple of whodunits that they had to deal with. But they're very intelligent, diligent, professional policemen, as good as I've ever seen. And they can devote a lot more manpower to a murder because they have so few. If that had happened here in any place in America, in a big city area, why, you, let's face it, you work on a murder for a relatively short period of time compared to over there.
Yeah, and then they close the books.
You have to, because you're going on to the next one and the next one and the next one. But over there, they just kept 100 men on the thing. For the longest time, trying to find that murder.
Well, I hope this DNA doesn't backfire and it turns out to be wrong someday. But I guess it's been supported scientifically. It's completely accurate.
Yeah, it can't be wrong. It's infallible, and there's not been a single scientist who has stepped up, either in England or America, and said this technology doesn't work. They've been doing DNA work for a long time. What Jeffries has done is to take the DNA work they've been doing for a long time and discover a way to actually lay it out and map it so you can look at it, you know, and identify a person from a picture in front of you. That's what Jeffries did. He sort of, if you will, there were fingerprints forever, but a few people came along about 100 years ago and figured a way to take these fingerprints, lay them out, and classify them in such a way that you could identify a human being from them. You know, that's what happened 100 years ago, and in a sense, that's what Jeffrey's done, and that's why he gave it the dramatic name. He called his discovery, though it has nothing to do with fingers, he called it genetic fingerprinting.
Now, apparently, it can also show family relationships as well, huh?
Yeah, because if you want to solve a problem with doubtful parentage, all you have to do now is just DNA the child, and the mother and father, and you will find the pattern of the father, who would be the questionable parent, in that genetic profile of the child. So there's, in essence, no such thing as a paternity suit anymore, no such thing as doubtful identity, not if you have the parents there to blood test.
Do you think the day will come that we will all be fingerprinted genetically at birth?
Yes.
Does that scare you?
No, because you can't stop progress like that. It's too big. It's too big. You know, a lot of people will say that there's a lot of opportunity for abuse of this, and there is. But you could no longer stop a discovery like this than you could have stopped the discovery of regular fingerprint classification, you know, back in the 1880s. It can't be stopped. It's too big. You cannot stop this kind of progress, so it's going to happen.
Well, Joseph Wambaugh, you're a terrific writer, and The Blooding is it's quite a thriller, the kind of book that you just don't want to put down. It's that sensational. I thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Don. It's great.